This podcast is brought to you by Upcase. Improve your development skills by completing coding exercises that are peer-reviewed by real humans. Learn more at upcase.com.
So this afternoon, my wife and two children came to Boston Common for the afternoon, and so I went out there and I met them for lunch. And there was this guy really pushing, making balloons for the kids. And he would, like, come up to the kids who were standing next to their parents and be like, "Hey, do you want me to make you a sword?" And I was very quick to interject no, because I have no idea how much money this guy's going to charge for the sword, you know? And I just didn't want to deal with that. So we sat down on the grass a little ways away, and this other family was hanging out, and the parents kind of had their back turned to the kids, and the kids kind of wandered over to the balloons, and the kid guy was like, "Hey, do you want me to make you a sword?" And the kid was like, "Yes, I want a sword." So the father turns around when this guy is like three quarters of the way done making the sword or whatever. So he finishes the sword and hands it over to the guy. And then he looks at the father like, "Okay, now you have to pay up." And the guy goes, "Your agreement was with my son." It's like, well,
you'll be hearing from my lawyers.
Yeah. I don't think he's old enough to enter into a binding contractual agreement with you for payment. I think he ended up giving him a dollar anyway, but I just laughed my ass off at that.
Yeah, that's really funny. That's, yeah.
Your agreement was with my son. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Derek.
Hi.
Hi.
How's your week going? So your last day at ThoughtBot was last Friday, which we discussed in the last show. This will come out a week delayed, so now a couple Fridays ago from when you're hearing this. In that time, you have tackled many a thing. What have you been doing? Are you enjoying your time? Are you taking time off? What's going on? Fill us in.
I'm kind of sort of taking time off. I'm teaching at Turing School, which is not technically time off, but I also have bills and want to buy a house soon, so it's kind of part-time and kind of lower pressure, so I'm spending time doing that, helping them, and then working on that new Rust ORM that we've been talking about a little bit. Making good headway on that.
Cool.
Playing some video games.
What are you playing? What do you have? What do you play?
Well, Hearthstone, a lot of. And then we just had a new expansion for that, and a bunch of indie games that I can't remember the name of.
So you play PC games, or?
Yeah, entirely PC.
Cool.
I upgraded to Windows 10. It's pretty nice.
Yeah. My dad's computer had Windows 10 on it when I went up and visited him in Maine. It seemed fine, I guess.
Start menu's back.
It's Windows. It looks more like Windows. Yeah, the start menu's nice. I don't know. It's all right. There's a blog we should link to. There's a developer who is from the Shop Talk Show podcast, and he is switching to... I think I shared this link with you because you were like, everybody's talking about it. We'll link it up in the show notes, but he's switching to Windows basically because he knew some people at Microsoft in like developer outreach and was like, how do we get some more of your type of developers onto this platform? So he was trying it out, and then it turned out that Rails was like the biggest nightmare for him to get running.
So that's actually a decent segue into a topic we can talk about.
I know. I didn't even mean it.
I don't think we discussed that at all.
Nope.
They are aware of that fact and are actively trying to improve it. And they being Microsoft.
Right.
That the story for Rails on Windows isn't great. And so they're doing lots of awesome things to improve that. I'm going to be most involved in the SQL Server and Azure SQL database stories. Trying to get that.
You are going to be involved. Is that what you said?
Yes. Okay. I don't know how much. I know that they have prefixed everything with we're doing the legwork, but we're looking for some guidance from the correct people in the various parts of the community. This is also for Django as well. And so they're having a big open source summit in Redmond in October, and they're flying a bunch of us out. So I'm going out for that. Ken Collins, who maintains the SQL Server adapter, is going to fly out for that. They're providing us with some CI servers for Windows, which will help a lot. And we haven't discussed too much a lot of the other things that need to improve on Windows because it's mostly the Azure team that's been reaching out. But the fact that Microsoft, the entity, gives any number of shits about open source, especially open source that they don't control, is astonishing to me and really, really cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's times are changing.
Right? Yeah, I mean, I hope so. I hope that's what it means.
This isn't the old embrace and extinguish approach, like it was taken with like Java and J-sharp. So, or whatever there, I think J-sharp came later, but whatever, something like that. This seems honest, like an interest in like, because like I know personally for me, I always liked having Macs, but at work I always had to use a PC for various reasons. Mm-hmm. And then I got into Rails development and I was still able to use a PC at the time. Like it wasn't terrible. It was pretty bad, actually. I did it all through RubyMine, which kind of helped a little bit, maybe. And then eventually just was enough and switched over to a Mac and never looked back. So I have no idea what it's like to try and run Ruby and Rails. I know there's like the Rails installer for Windows, but I have no idea. Like PowerShell was barely a thing the last time I was using Windows. So now like there's a nice shell environment supposedly on Windows. That's what I'm told.
Right. And there's also what's the Unix on Windows one?
I don't remember. Cygwin.
Yeah, Cygwin.
Cygwin's a nightmare. Don't get me started on Cygwin.
All right.
I had to use Cygwin for that was another. I can't remember was I using it for trying to do Rails stuff. That was around the same time that I was just like, all right, if I'm going to bother with Cygwin, I should just run something that has a Unix-y shell.
You know, people always talk about Windows as like this thing that's like, yeah, we could probably support Windows better, but nobody's using it. Except there's this aspect of it that we always forget to think about, which is that Macs are really expensive. And if you are a person who's not already a developer, who's looking at maybe trying to learn Rails, which is what programs like Rails Bridge, you know, bring a lot of people into, you're more likely to own a Windows machine than a Mac.
Right. And I think, you know, you mentioned Rails Bridge. I think, I don't know if this is like program wide. I've never volunteered there, but I know I was talking to Gabe, who one of our coworkers who volunteers there. And he mentioned that I think what they did was they have a VirtualBox image. So when people show up with Windows machines, they're just like, here, install this VirtualBox image for to get you running with, you know, the stuff.
That's not what they do in Denver. Here we just have a person who's the Windows expert.
Right. Raise your hand if you're using Windows and run around trying to
fix half the
problems.
Room raises their hand and this one person's the only one who can help them most of the time.
Like what are the problems? What are the classes of problems? File paths and drive letters and things like that, I imagine.
That's a big one. I mean, anything that overly relies on Unix, which, yeah, usually comes down to file paths, but can also come into forking behavior or what syscalls you're using.
Oh, right. I mean, does Windows fork? Windows doesn't fork.
No, you can fork on Windows. It just works a little bit differently.
Okay.
I don't remember the exact differences, and you're not likely to run into them. But my point being, if you're overly relying on it happening exactly in the Unix way, which, again, I don't remember exactly what the difference between the Unix way and not the Unix way on that one is. But, yeah, actually, file paths and drive letters was ones that the specific cases that came up recently for Sprockets in particular, where just it doesn't work on Windows at all right now due to something where it's assuming the file paths being like slash being the root path. And that was where the discussion of just we should probably have CI for Windows started coming out of, because we don't have CI for Windows. Like Sprockets did work. The released version does work on Windows and Master doesn't, or I don't know if it still doesn't if we fix it or not, but like we should have known that happened.
Right.
When it comes to SQL Server, a couple of the missing things that have come up so far are lack of support for many, many types that are not ANSI standard but SQL Server supports, which, hey, we've got new stuff to help with that, which will be good.
Right.
And then also, I guess, and I don't know all of the details because I've only had a handful of brief calls at this point, but I guess the way we handle authentication for the database doesn't, like there is a ton of really common cases with SQL Server that just are not possible with the way Rails has it set up.
Okay. Well, it'll be interesting to watch.
Yeah. And beyond that, I don't know other specifics other than the vague feeling, like you were just saying, that it seems like a lot of, like everybody on Windows has issues with Rails, and I'm not entirely sure what the exact reasons are, but we should, even if there's nothing that's straight out, like straight up broken, it still, we should strive to make it, especially given that the most likely person to be developing a Rails app on Windows is a brand new developer. We need to make sure that isn't frustrating.
And I feel like that's part of the problem, right? If you have a brand new developer who's running into these problems, they have a limited ability to describe to you the problem.
Right.
And have limited hypotheses on what the problem could actually be. And the people who are more experienced are like, screw this, I'm not using Windows. I'm going to go buy you know, or I'm going to install Linux, or I'm going to go buy an
MacBook. Again, that's still assuming they can afford it.
Right. But so what
or
I'm getting
know
at,
how to install Linux.
What I'm getting at is, like, if I were Microsoft and I really wanted to attack this problem, I would do exactly what they're doing, it sounds like, which is, like, yeah. contact people who are in the community in the position to solve these problems, give them hardware. Be like, here is your Windows laptop. I'm not going to make you run this in a VM. I'm not going to make, like, here's a, you know, a nice $1,000 Windows laptop.
Yeah.
Go at it. And, you know, run all your tests on this. And then also, like you said, like, we're going to give you hosted CI environments that can run Windows, and we're going to pay for it. Because, you know, you don't have any money to pay for these things. It's an open source project.
Well, and here's the other thing that they're doing, though, at least on the SQL Server side of things. They're saying, we're not necessarily asking you to devote a ton of your time to this. We're happy with having our engineers do all of the legwork on it, as long as you can help give us some guidance.
Perfect. But still, I mean, even being able to give that guidance is going to require, like...
It's going to require time.
And some familiarity with the platform. Like,
yes. Oh, definitely.
Like, I am so... it's to the point now where, like, family members ask me questions about Windows. I'm like, I don't know. Control panel, something. I don't know. My computer? That's all I got. I used to be the person that was, you know, the go-to helper for Windows things, but not anymore. And I also feel like... I feel like that's also part of their problem on the web, you know... Maybe not with regards to most web development, who, you know, that's still probably PHP, Java, which works fine on Windows as far as I know.
Yep.
But, like, designers and people like that are often using Macs, right? So, like, front end, and if they're not using Macs, they're not using IE for the most part, from what I can tell. You know, people are using Chrome and Firefox.
It's Microsoft Edge now.
Right. Yeah. And how many people have you ever tried anything on Microsoft Edge?
Yeah.
You have?
Actually.
Oh, because you just installed Windows 10. That's right.
It's actually a nice browser. I'm thinking about switching to it from Chrome.
Right. But I feel like that, like, when a few years ago they were finally like, okay, we're going to make these VMs available so you can download VMs for IE6, IE7, IE8, IE9.
Right.
And it was such a hassle. And they expire after 30 days. And they have the, like, activation thing, so that's why they expire, and you have to reinstall them. It's such a like, they made it, like, congratulations, but I don't know.
It was better the last time I did it, because they've got this fancy, modern-looking website where it definitely wasn't a VM that expired. It just couldn't really do anything other than, like, run IE. And then IE 11 and 10 can both emulate all versions of IE going back to, I think, 4.
Yeah, that gets you pretty far. But there are times when you just, like, I need to run this actual browser. Like, if you go into developer tools in IE 9, I think it started in 9, you're able to, like, oh, God, it's been so long. You're able to, like, set the target IE version and have it render as if it's IE
right.
8, like, bug-for-bug compatibility, supposedly.
Bug-for-bug compatibility. That's the thing, though, is that, A, if I'm supporting 8 or 9 at all at this point, which is unlikely... I'm probably going to just trust that the emulation does actually work.
Yeah.
Rather than actually go through the trouble to figure... I wouldn't even know how to get actual IE8.
Right.
At this point.
There used to be a project, IEVMs, that, like, tried to dance around some of those. I wonder if that's still a thing. X-Descent IEVMs is the GitHub project. So, yeah, it looks like it's still a thing. Where it tries to automate, like, downloading those approved IEVMs and... refreshing them every however long you need to refresh them, stuff like that. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. I had other IE things, as I say. Oh, the IE support, like the browser support thing. Like, I wonder if that's also a position of privilege that we're in, like with the types of clients that we're able to say, like I think we recently just said we don't even support IE9 anymore by default, unless you can make a business case for what we have to on a particular project.
That's because the general consumer, even those on Windows, have upgraded beyond IE9.
I guess it was just getting past the requirement for XP, right?
Right.
And once you could safely say we no longer care about Windows XP, but if, like, you're developing anything for China, right, then...
Right. Well, and then, because XP was the cutoff for 6. Vista's the cutoff for 9.
Right. XP. So if you're on XP, you cannot get to IE9. You can only get to IE8.
You get to IE8, yeah. Right. And then if you are on Vista, you can only get to 9. If you're on Windows 7, you can get 10, and I think you can also get 11, but once you get to 10, it's fine. I guess Flexbox doesn't work in IE 10 properly, but Flexbox doesn't really work in anything properly, so
Hey, we used it one time. It worked okay. It was kind of, we had to add some wrapping stuff to make it work the way you wanted to work. I don't know. It was all right. So what is the, what's the feeling been like with the people that you've talked to about like Microsoft getting involved here? Like there's always, I feel like there's always a reaction of people being like, oh, corporate people getting involved with open source. They're going to like pay Sean Griffin all this money. And he's going to, instead of spending his time on the attributes API version 2 or whatever the heck you want to spend your time on next, you're going to like start working on SQL Server integration.
But, you know, that's the funny thing. So, A, I would actually be really, I would be really pleased if the way it goes down is I bill them as a contractor and spend some time solving their problems. But the thing is, improving the story for third party, because we're not going to add a SQL Server adapter to Rails. That is definitely never going to happen. We cannot have an adapter that the majority of our contributors can't run the tests for in Tree. But I've been wanting to improve the story for third party adapters for a while now and get and come up, figure out what the public, like the public stable API for that is, so that an adapter doesn't have to be in Tree to feel like it has first class support. And I mean, JDBC still doesn't support 4.2 100%.
Right.
That is a huge problem for me because I'm a, you know, JRuby as well. I'm a huge fan of, and the JRuby story for Rails is really abysmal as well. So,
yeah, I mean, and it sounds like in Microsoft you have somebody who's willing to help you from that side of like, we know connectivity to our database, right? We can help you here.
And if somebody wants to throw support at the problem, it's not going to hurt.
Right, and they're reaching out to Ken to say, who's, you know, the maintainer, Ken Collins, the maintainer of the SQL Server adapter. And then they're reaching out to you and other people involved with Rails. So they're trying to get everybody's attention focused on an area. And like, I think there's enough that everybody in that equation can gain. Like Microsoft gains because they get better connectivity for SQL Server. So people in the enterprise that are running SQL Server don't have to be like, well, we got to switch to Postgres because our developers want to run Rails or something like that.
Right.
And then, you know, Ken gains because he feels like, you know, the adapter that he maintains and likely uses, I suppose, you know, gets better support as feels more of a first class citizen. And we all gain because, you know, you're not just going to make this special case stuff for your SQL Server. It's going to be something that's more broadly useful to like make third party adapters more first class citizens.
Yeah. Well, and I think the entire Rails community will also gain because once I have a stable public API for third party adapters and I, like something that is clearly broad enough that it covers all of the cases that it needs to for the four entry adapters. I guess probably my litmus test is if it supports the four entry adapters, if it supports JDBC, and if it supports SQL Server, and if it can handle all of those needs, I'm comfortable with that's a broad enough API that like any third party adapter is going to be fine. And at that point, we can move MySQL 1 adapter into a gem. Not deprecated, because there's still legitimate use cases that the MySQL 2 gem cannot handle. I know GitHub is on the MySQL 1 gem. I don't know who else is, but like major users who, anyway, it won't be a deprecated thing, but we can kind of move it out of Tree, and it won't be a place that we have to ever really focus time on because it's going to do what it does. And unless I make breaking changes to a public API, which is something I do very sparingly and with deprecation cycles, we can be confident that like the legacy code there will continue to work.
Right. The four entry adapters are SQLite, MySQL 1, MySQL 2, and Postgres. Is that it?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds like a good plan. And then eventually, like, then you could get to the point where, what's the PostGIS? So, like, PostGIS has to be implemented as its own adapter, right? And PostGIS adds on support for, like, the geo-tagging, geo-location stuff in Postgres.
It doesn't, right? In Rails 4.2. It doesn't in Rails 5 either, although in both of those cases, it is still going to have to hook into some internal implementation details, but it's definitely possible to add support for PostGIS without being implemented as an adapter now.
Right, but it is currently, right?
It is currently, and it's going to continue to be until they're willing to drop support for all versions prior to 4.2.
Right. And the problem with that is, like, maybe it works just fine, but then when changes are made to the underlying adapters, that might screw things up, or if you want to layer on something else, you can't do that.
Or if I want to have a second non-standard plugin.
Right. Right, that's what I meant. You wanted to, if you wanted to layer on, like, you know, I don't know what that would be, but there's probably something else from Postgres that you could layer on there, and then you're gonna have them battling. And that's like, I feel like this is one of the very long-standing, the two places where I feel like there's a very long-standing acceptance of like, oh, you just do this with this private Rails API, and there's very successful and prominent gems, are in adapters, and also in schema stuff. schema dumpers and things like that. Like that's, there's no public API for that, but they're everywhere.
But that's the thing, is that they've been coincidentally successful. Like that's why there's, you know, a decent sized group of folks in that kind of world who are very angry at me, because since I've come on board, those internal APIs are the things I've been fiddling with and moving around.
Right. And but I understand that from both perspectives, right? Like you have to be able to move the internals forward so that maybe someday you can get to a point where you provide a nice clean public API. But in the meantime, all these people were just trying to get their work done, right?
Yes.
And they're like, well, it won't let me use this type of column, and I want to do it. So I'm going to introduce a thing that allows you to, you know, use this type of value in the database or whatever, or create views. Somebody maintains one of those. I don't know. You know, so they just wanted to get that done, and they looked at the available code out there and were like, okay, this is how you do it. Like, yeah, this feels weird, but it's not even necessarily like, I feel like you could be doing Rails for a long time and not realize that what you're doing is not public API.
Yeah. Like, I've got a blog post that gets cited all the time and used to be part of the Turing curriculum until I made them take it out, which was about using ARL to make SQL queries.
Right.
ARL's private API.
But you have to do it sometimes. Like if you wanted to write an OR statement with whatever,
you just write some SQL.
Right. Yeah.
But no, you know, it's funny that you, like, they just wanted to get their work done, and I agree. And it's funny, when I think back to, because I did little commits here and there before I really started, like, the Attributes API became the thing I focused on. And even the Attributes API, though, all of this, before you and I were together on T1D, I was on a very brief project. And for weird reasons, there was a requirement that the data had to be encrypted at rest. Like, not just the database itself was encrypted, but if access to the database was compromised, the data needed to be unreadable, which was problematic because we needed to implement like an advanced search panel and do queries more complicated than equality or inequality, which if you're querying against encrypted data, that's the only thing you can do, assuming, because then, I mean, those are easy, right? Then you just encrypt it client side, then where encrypted data equals this encrypted string. But if you need to do a like statement or less than, something like that, you need to decrypt it in your query.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to do this in such a way that it didn't require all consuming code to know or care. I want to just write kind of normal, well, normal assuming that you're going to use ARL. Normal like if you're using Ransack, I guess, kind of code. And that was just flat out impossible on Rails 4. This was Rails 4.0, 3.2, either 3.2 or 4.0. And now, and 2.5 years later, there's finally a public API. Because that was the thing. It was like, I actually did kind of do this hacky thing, and then it turned out the gem couldn't friggin' update to 4.1 or get security patches because it relied on internal everything everywhere. But then I guess I took the correct approach and contribute to Rails to get the public API there to make it possible without relying on internals, but that took a very long time.
Right. And so now the nicety of that is, like, we've talked about the Attributes API a lot, but you, like, the Attributes API also helps you in where. So you could declare, like, this is an encrypted attribute, and when you are typecasting for the database, this is what you do.
Yeah. And then it encrypts it, or it modifies the query to do PG crypto stuff. And then when it's going to the database and where, it can create the SQL that decrypts it.
Right. Cool.
You would actually still, I guess, have to rely on one internal method to make that happen. I do need to come up with a story for that, like where you need control over quoting behavior and also over whether or not a type is used in a prepared statement. Because in this case, you could still use it in a prepared statement. I need to think about that some more, actually, because that is a little bit of a hole.
Hasn't come up yet.
2.5 years ago.
All right. So let's take a quick break and tell you about our sponsor for today's episode. It's Media Temple. So Media Temple's been around for a really long time. I think I remember first hearing about them in the early 2000s. And I definitely checked them out then. I wasn't in a position where I needed a lot of their services, but they're still around and they're still a premium platform for designers, developers, and creative professionals. So when you sign up for Media Temple, what you get is a server on their grid, basically. And a grid is a bunch of servers together that can handle a large load. So using your Grid account, you can host whatever it is you want. You can host a portfolio site. You can host all of your client projects, like hundreds of them, whatever it is you have. So with your one, say you're a freelancer and you have, you know, 10, 20, 30 clients, you can get one Grid server and serve their sites off of that potentially. And that hosting is going to stand up to a big load. Like if you get on the front page of Hacker News or Reddit, it's not going to be a problem. If somebody else on your cluster of servers gets onto the front page of Reddit or Hacker News, it's not going to be a problem. They handle noisy neighbors and traffic spikes like that without a problem. So if all you want to do is get up running quickly with WordPress or anything like that, they have the typical one-click installs that you see places. They have a really great control panel that's nice to look at, easy to use. And on top of it all, they have fantastic support. So I have friends that have Media Temple accounts, and they have called at like 10 p.m. on a Saturday and had somebody cheery on the other end who's happy to help you. So I'd encourage you to check out Media Temple, and as a special discount for BikeShed listeners, you can use the promo code BIKE25 for 25% off your web hosting. Go to MediaTemple.net and enter your promo code upon signup. Thanks again to Media Temple for sponsoring the show.
Thanks, Media Temple. So you want to talk about this Rust ORM that I've been working on?
Sure. This is becoming the Rust show. I'm okay with it. I wish I knew more Rust, but it's the Rusty.
This is my attempt to force you to learn more Rust. This is actually how we convert new developers.
We just keep talking about it on the podcast?
Do a podcast with them, keep talking about Rust, and then they have to learn Rust so that they can talk about it.
This is a long con.
Yes. No, it's been cool. It's I've gotten through the majority of that document I sent you however long ago it was that we were talking about that. Was it last week?
Yep. You gotten through the majority of that? Yeah. We recorded this a week ago. Less than a week ago. We recorded last Thursday, I think, or something like that. Last Wednesday.
Yeah. Well, I got through the majority of that. Like everything that doesn't require a compiler plugin, and it's actually looking way better than I thought it was going to without compiler plugins. The problem with compiler plugins being that they require nightly Rust.
Right.
Because they're not stable. And not documented, because it's basically they expose the entire internals of the compiler. And just to clarify for anybody who's not familiar with Rust, Rust has macros, which allow you to do nice things to avoid having to write lots of boilerplate code, but they are very limited in what they can do.
They're akin to the metaprogramming that gets done with like association code in Rails, right? That's not a macro, but a lot of Rails developers think of that as a macro.
Right.
It's executing at runtime, not at compile time. That's the difference.
Right.
Correct.
And this executes at compile time, but it's more template expansion than anything else. But you can't do things like have conditionals, for example. At least not conditional. Like you couldn't have it generate different code depending on like what was passed to it. It's really just template expansion. And then compiler plugins also look like macros to the consumer. However, you do still have to explicitly say, I want to enable this plugin. And then instead of it just expanding a template, what it's going to do is call a function, which takes in an abstract syntax tree and can do whatever it wants. It's just it's an arbitrary Rust function, and it returns an abstract syntax tree.
Okay.
And so I've come up with now a concrete to-do list, and I've basically separated everything into, like, for every little piece of SQL, I want to see the type-safe API that works on stable, the unsafe API that will allow for arbitrary SQL and works on stable, and the type-safe API, which works with arbitrary SQL but would require a compiler plugin or some form of code gen. That's the alternative, is I could probably get it on stable Rust by having some functions that you can call from your build script that just generate the code instead before it compiles the rest of your application, and that would work on stable. So I've got select pretty much done, minus code gen stuff, and I'm making headway through various types of joins. And I end up with this really neat little API that came out of it. So there's a little bit of boilerplate that will ultimately be fixed by a schema dumper, but where you just say, hey, there's a table with this shape, and then you also say, hey, I have this struct, and I want to be able to query it from a table with this shape. And I don't ever explicitly associate I query a user struct from the user's table. I keep it a little more generic than that. And then each of the columns gets represented now as what's called a unit struct. So it's a struct that has zero fields. And then I have a trait called column, which is generic over a table. And so then I implement column generic over the user's table for each column in the user's table. And then in my select function, I'm able to say I take any column C where C implements column for me.
Okay. What was the point of the struct that has no fields?
So basically this is a way of pushing all of this. Like, so it's a thing, you can assign it to a variable, you can refer to it by name, and you can pass it around like an argument, but you can also refer to it as a type. And any code that you actually write that actually does anything with it will be erased because there is absolutely nothing you can do with it because it has zero fields. And so it has a size of zero, which means it takes up zero memory.
Okay.
So you can't actually do anything useful with it. But what this ends up meaning is, so like one alternative, that there's a lot of reasons that this wouldn't quite work for the way I've been taking this, but I could have used an enum where like there was the column enum for the user's table, right? And then each of the members of that enum was one of the columns. But even if every member of that enum had zero fields, the size of that enum itself would still be one, because at runtime now, you can actually store which of these you have, because the type isn't now user's ID. The type is user's column, and we need to be able to differentiate between that. And then the code that you use to do stuff generic over it would be pattern matching. And so then the compiled code's going to end up being, it stores basically a one-byte field to tell you which column it is, and then a giant if statement. Whereas with the way I've got it, the code that'll actually get generated, the machine code, will look like if you just wrote by hand really, really, really specifically tightly coupled code to the exact query that you were doing.
Right.
It's going to lead to a little bigger binary overall, but it's going to be, you know, more efficient. And also I'm able to do much more interesting things at the type level with them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, because it's not an enum, it's just a trait that I implement generic over the table. The way I select multiple columns is you pass me a tuple of two or more columns. And I've got some code that says for any tuple of two columns where column A is of type A and belongs to table A, and column B is of type B and belongs to table B, that tuple can be considered a column of type tuple of the type of A and the type of B that belongs to a table that is the tuple of the table of A and the table of B. And that last bit's actually really this really interesting journey I had this morning, because as of last night, the table of the resulting column wasn't actually a tuple of the two tables. It was just I would assume that the two columns belong to the same table, because when I had originally written this trait, it was assuming that, or this tuple logic, it was assuming that this was because you're selecting ID and name from your user's table. But then what came out of it was, so then I started working on joins. And I had to make the select function a little bit more generic, because a column is generic over the table belongs to, and a column definitely only ever belongs to a table. Actually, I had to remove that as well. But a column belongs to a thing of type, called type T, and in places where it needs to be a table, I constrain it to be a table. But I then had to make that a little bit more generic and not reason about columns, but reason about selectable columns. Which is generic over the table that it comes from and the query source that you can select it from. So that way you can select it from the join query source. And then any column that belongs to table T is a selectable column of T and T, originating from table T, and it is selectable from table T. And then for the inner join query source, what I wanted to write, which I couldn't write, and I've got, there are several ways that this will be fixed in the future. I wanted to be able to say, so for a joined query source where there is the left side and the right side, any column belonging to the left side is a selectable column originating from the left side and selectable from the join between the left and right. And then any column that belongs to the right side is a selectable column originating from the right side that is selectable from the inner join between the left and right side. The problem with that is, because I'm representing this as a trait, and traits usually have methods on them, this is specifically what's called a marker trait. It's a trait with no behavior. But when traits do have behavior, there needs to be no ambiguity about what behavior to use. You know, like there's a trait called add, which defines what the plus operator does for a given type, and it's generic over the right-hand side in the output. But like, you couldn't have two implementations that overlap, because then in the case of overlap, like, what logic do you actually run?
This is similar to including a module in Ruby where you have the same
method. Yeah, they both had a method of the same name.
Right, and in Ruby, the last one wins. So that's what they do.
But then here, this isn't so much about namespace collisions. This is more about types.
Mm-hmm.
and more just multiple things saying it. I mean, you would have this. You can have the same problem in Haskell when you're implementing a type class. And the reason that definition I just said for the inner join source is illegal is because that is an overlapping implementation, because there's no evidence that left and right aren't the same thing. And in the case that they are the same thing, that is ambiguous. Now, there's a thing that's going to be coming soon called specialization, which allows you to have overlapping implementations for traits as long as one implementation is clearly more specific than the other. So as long as it entirely contains the other set. And so if you're more specific, then you can create a new one. And then it also allows
give an example of more specific. Like, what do you mean by that?
So if I've got some like parsing trait and I write an implementation for a vector of type T, and then I write an implementation for a vector of an unsigned byte.
Okay.
That is a clearly more specific implementation. It can get broader than that, and it can simply be like additional constraints or state like two different saying something that is generic over T and U versus something that's generic over T and T. The latter is more specific because it's specifically in the case with the same type.
So if something matched both of those, it would just choose to run the more specific.
Right. And the restriction there basically comes down to, if you think of the set of everything that the first one could cover and the set of everything the second one could cover, the first one needs to entirely contain the second one.
Right. I'm glad I don't write compilers.
Yeah. Well, it also allows, though, for you to have just generically overlapping where, like, one's not more specific than the other. And in this case, what we do is you just say you explicitly say, here's what to do in the case of overlap.
Okay.
and then that resolves it. But anyway, so my thing when I ran into this was like, okay, but none of this matters because there's no methods on this. We should just remove the restriction on overlapping implementations for any trait that has no methods, because there's absolutely no reason not to.
Right. Yeah. At that point, you're just using it to help with type matching, right? Yeah,
exactly. I'm doing it to basically do algebra in the type system. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so, and that all worked. And I have a workaround where I'm now, when you say that how you can join between two columns, and you're doing, and I have people doing, I have you doing that in a macro right now, I also then generate a more specific implementation that says any column that belongs to the users table can be selected from a join between the users and the posts table. And I'm so becoming super specific there. But then I got into this interesting case where at this point, a column was constrained to be generic over a table. And so a selectable column had to originate from a table. And then that broke for me when I wrote the test case that said, and I can select two columns from different tables from a join that aren't select users.star, post.star. So my test was users.name and post.title.
Mm-hmm.
Because I could write a generic implementation, like given a tuple of a column A that has a type of A, that has a type of source A and a table of table A, and a column, you know, and all of that with B instead, and all of these constraints that says like they can be joined between each other and all the other stuff. And then it would have looked like a selectable column of type tuple of type of A and tuple and type of B. And then the second parameter there is supposed to be the table that it originates from. And then the third parameter is the source can be queried from. And in this case, the source is the inner join, or I just have it generically any query source. But that's like, but what do you put for the table? Because a tuple of table A and table B is not a table. And I not only do I not want to make it a table, I can't make it a table because there's one method you have to implement on table, which is name. And like, what's the name of that table?
Right.
And that's going to get used to construct queries. So I can't just put like A comma B. That will be a syntax error. And I can't just say it's from table A because that's clearly incorrect. And in fact, Rust, rightfully so, does not compile if I try to do that, because it'll complain that like you're generic over this thing called table of B, but you're not actually using it in the types that you're reasoning about. So you can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then it occurred to me, my problem was that when I'd previously needed to select multiple columns, I considered a tuple of two columns from the same table to originate from that table. But they don't. They actually originate from a tuple, like a tuple of users ID and users posts doesn't originate from users. It originates from a tuple of users and users.
Okay. Right.
Right. But that is technically more correct. It is multiple columns and they might have multiple sources, and all of this still works out. And as soon as I just removed the original thing that said that they're from the same table and then loosened my constraint on things have to be over a table, because it actually worked if I just loosened the constraint that, like, if I made it so column is generic over T instead of T, which must be a table. Mm-hmm. But then my older test where I was selecting multiple columns from a single table stopped compiling because now it doesn't know what the table that those columns are abstracting over are because it's a tuple. So is it a tuple of users and users or is it users? And it took me a while to figure out that's where it was saying that this is ambiguous. And when I finally figured out, I'm like, oh, and then that makes sense. It originates from a tuple of two tables, which happen to be the same. And then everything else still holds. If I can write in code in the type system proof that when they originate from two tables, that they can only be selected from the thing that allows you to select from both tables, then that all holds true for when I'm dealing with a single table as well. And so trying to select a column from posts from the user's table still doesn't compile. A tuple between a column from users and a column from posts still doesn't compile. And it was really cool.
Yeah. I've been kind of following along with your commits. Can we tell the people the very secret location of this project?
We'll put it in the show notes. Yeah. It's early days. As of right now, I realize that even my workaround for the overlapping impulse thing actually doesn't work because it relies on the fact that my tests are in the same crate. Are you familiar with orphan instances in Haskell?
No, I am not.
So an orphan instance is when you implement a instance of a type class from another module for a type that lives in another module. So you do not own the type that you're implementing it for or the type class that you're implementing. Mm-hmm. And that's called an orphan instance. And it is explicitly disallowed by the compiler. And there is no way to allow it in Rust.
Why?
It basically breaks soundness of... I don't understand the full implications of it, but from my layman's understanding of it, it is tightly tied to... parameteristicity, something like that. it has to do with when something is generic over a certain type, you can reason that can only do things based on that specific constraint. And so specialization breaks that because a more specific implementation might do other things because it can know more things. And the drop checker in Rust, the thing that makes sure that like when a variable goes out of scope, it drops and everything belonging to it drops. And all of the stuff that we do to push garbage collection into compile time checks relies on that. And this somehow relates to that. I don't remember the exact reason, but I remember reading that there is a specific reason and it's important. Anyway, and so I can't actually, and that basically means that I can't ever implement for a trait that I don't own. I can't say I implement that trait for type T where, and it doesn't matter what constraints I put on type T. Because that's a wild card deal. Mm-hmm. And somebody else then, in a further transitive dependency, could then implement my trait for a type that they own. And so the compiler, when compiling my crate, can't actually tell all of the places that the trait might be used.
Right. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Kind of. we'll put a link in the show notes. Yeah.
It's at sgrift/YAQB, which I assume yet another query builder. Is that where we're going with here?
Yep.
Okay.
That is not the name it's going to ship with. That is the name I typed in because I needed something
right
to give to GitHub.
But I'm looking through it now, and it's interesting because there's like good commit messages, even though the audience is currently yourself. So that's nice to see. So if you
other developers includes you next week,
right? But it's nice because if you are kind of following along with what's going on with Rust, but some of the stuff is like hard, like, you know, when we're talking about something being generic over T and blah 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 blah, you can be kind of hard to follow. But if you step through these commits here, you can kind of watch the evolution of it. And right now there's only, I don't know, 15 commits or something like that. Let's see.
No, it's
27 commits. Whatever. Yeah. You could follow. You could go through every single one of those right now if you wanted. By the time you hear this next week, there might be 50. But, you know, who knows?
I do want to throw out a couple of qualifiers on this, too. A, for all of the stuff I'm talking about where, like, really, really hard logic. This is all internal in the library that the users are never going to have to worry about. And the actual usage for what I do have so far seriously looks a lot like Rails, and I think that's really cool. Like, it's just user.select name and age, but we have all kinds of guarantees. You can't actually get something out of that isn't of the correct type.
Right.
If the column is nullable, you have to get an option out of it. You can't select columns that don't exist on that table, that are from another table, that aren't part of your query. And you can do all the stuff. And it's actually slightly fewer characters than Rails because you don't have to quote the string. Because you're not past the string. And then the other thing is, too, with all the stuff that we're talking about, for people who are maybe me talking about all this really weird, deep, generic stuff in Rust, I don't want anyone to get scared off from that because what I'm doing is not kind of normal usage. It's because I'm writing absurdly generic code. And it's not even because I'm trying to do something. It's because I'm trying to very specifically disallow a lot of stuff. And so all of this reasoning I'm having to do with the types isn't so much about what I'm trying to say I can do. Well, it is about what I'm – but the reason I'm having to do all this legwork is because I've gone through the trouble of explicitly disallowing all kinds of incorrect queries,
right,
which then means I, the developer, or the framework developer now, have to prove to the compiler and the type system that what I am writing in my tests is actually a valid query. And but now I'm forced to provide proof that I wouldn't have otherwise had to provide.
But that's where the interest lies. And we talked about that last week.
Yeah.
That's where the interest really lies, is that, you know, you could build yet another query builder, or you could build yet another query builder that is backed by types.
Right. And the important thing for me being that you don't lose composability, the ability to drop back to raw SQL when you need to, and that you don't have to write a lot of boilerplate. Like, I don't want this to be harder to use than whatever Active Record would look like in Rust.
I still need a Rust project. Got to figure something out.
You should just come help me on this query builder.
Yeah. That probably wouldn't go very well. I can write an app that uses your query builder when you're ready, and I'll write a blog that uses your query builder. We can go from there.
once I get something figured out so that I don't have to, I'm probably going to ultimately end up with schema.toml. And then I'll be able...
More markup languages.
Yehuda says just use toml. TOML's the go-to.
That's the Rust everything. Thing.
That's what Rust uses instead of YAML.
Right. So TOML is Tom's markup language, right?
Right. But people actually use it all the time and don't even realize it. Like, if you have a .ini file, that is TOML. Or
right.
It's a subset of TOML, most likely.
Well, yeah, TOML backed into that from the Windows ini file days.
Right. Anyway, it's what we use.
We just
we
went
use.
Full circle back to Windows.
But yeah, then I can have a build script and you call one function that generates schema.rs at compile time, and that'll help me work around a lot of it. And then I think at that point I'm going to try and start moving parts of crates.io onto this, not actually submitting it to them like, hey, you should switch to this thing, but just as sort of I have a real world user with real world needs, even though I don't, and I'll just be actually porting it myself, but like using that to kind of drive a lot of where I go next. I'm really excited to get to where. Because I was going to be like, I'm not gonna implement ARL. I'm not going to implement ARL. And now that I've got like the way select took me, I'm totally going to do ARL. I can write so much that is provably correct. I know exactly what operators can or can't exist for every type. I know exactly what arguments they can take. And I can have, like, if I actually just need to do this one without even getting to where. But, like, I could do select column A plus column B. And literally the code for that is dot select column A space plus column B, because the add trait in Rust lets you specify the output type,
right?
And it doesn't have to be either, like, either side of the and so yeah.
So if
it's
you know
be,
if you know A and B are integers or whatever, then you know when you select A plus B, that's an integer. Is that what you're getting at?
No, well, yes, but it's more like I'll be able to write the code that says that that implements add, for example, where the left side is a column of a set of types that can be added, mm-hmm. and the right side is a column that can be added with type A, and then the output of that will be an AST, like some sort of generic AST type, but then that also encodes what, because I'll know what the result of added, well, and it'll be generic over the SQL type of those, and that'll be, that will presumably be a thing that is unchanged, because I don't think there is any form of addition that you can do in SQL that would return a different type.
Right. That makes sense.
Depending on how strict it is. I mean, I guess integer plus float probably does float. Postgres probably makes you cast.
Who knows?
Anyway, but that's, yeah. But I can encode all of this, and it's going to be really cool. And I'm going to try and implement it in such a way that's still open-ended. This is why I feel like I am a good person to be working on something like this, is because I am thinking about all of the issues, like the PostGIS adapter, right? Because I've had to deal with that and had to, you know, figure out how to then bring all that kind of stuff in later. And a lot of this stuff is way harder to deal with after the fact. The one concession I am making is right now I'm tightly coupling to Postgres.
It's fine. Do it.
Yeah.
Microsoft can come calling 3 years from now and say that they want.
It's going to be so much harder if I do it then. But yeah. But it'll be cool too, because if I do this right, I'll be able to make it so that I know what this operator works on MySQL between these two types, but doesn't work on PostgreSQL between those two types. because the type integer will be different on MySQL than on Postgres, and I'll just have a configuration flag. Like, I'll probably have it be you can ask for the specific ones if for some reason you're connecting to multiple databases in the same app. Mm-hmm. Or you can just set a compiler flag that's like, I'm using Postgres. And then the generic not database constrained names will ultimately just be an alias for the Postgres ones.
Right.
Is what I'm thinking. And I don't know if that'll work because I haven't tried it yet. But yeah, it's going to be really cool. I'm really excited about it.
Provably correct queries.
Provably correct.
All right. Should we wrap up?
Yeah, let's wrap up.
Okay. Show notes for this episode can be found at bikeshed.fm/32.
As always, ratings and reviews on iTunes are much appreciated.
If you have feedback about this show or any other show, you can tweet us at _bikeshed, email us at hosts@bikeshed.fm, or leave feedback on the website.
Thanks for listening to Bike Shed, and we'll see you next time.
Where we will talk about Rust.
Probably.